So, by the way, where's the remote? Or do we have the page turn, or we got to do it from here?
Maybe if you point your map in there, but it doesn't. You have to advance with the button.
Really? Okay. All right. So, the topic for this talk started about a couple of, I'm forgetting now, maybe a year ago or so. I was at a SIAM conference in Rutgers, and they asked me to comment on the crisis. And this led to two papers, which are the content of today's talk. Now, I guess if I was to present the papers, you do research in one way, and then you finally write it up, and you see so many other things that are more important than what you initially started with that you have to rewrite everything upside down. But I'm going to basically present it the way I fell into it and how it actually arose. And I'll point out some of the new things that have been observed since, which I never knew and didn't realize about the models and the results when I wrote the paper. In fact, these things came out because of answering questions by editors and referees. So you learn things that you don't know when you start with. But when I started with, I was commenting on the financial crisis, and basically I was partly also engaged in setting up hedge funds. And I'm sitting there in the back of the room watching my colleagues negotiate with hedge funds, negotiate with people on setting these things up. And I'm saying to myself, that the ability to trade electronically in thousands of assets in numerous markets simultaneously at an ever-increasing frequency is quite a privileged access to a service with dangerous consequences if you get caught short. I mean, you can do this kind of thing. You can say, I want to set up a $100 million long-short hedge fund, and I'm going to invest in many, many markets, and I'm going to be trading with such high frequency. And remember, when I say $100 million long-short fund, I sell $100 million worth of stuff, and I use that money to buy another $100 million worth of stuff. How much of my money is in there? Not a penny. Okay, I haven't put any money up. And of course, if I say that I'm a pauper on the streets, a homeless guy on the streets of New York, and I want to set up a $100 million long-short fund, nobody's going to let me do it. They're going to say, you got to show some ability to cover losses. You can't just come and trade out here. And so you start negotiating. You say, okay, how much do you want? What are you going to give me? Look, my volatility is not that high. So they say, okay, maybe we give you 5-to-1, 20 million. So let me say, okay, I'll call you back later, and we talk to somebody else, and he say, can you do for 10, man? Look at this wall. I mean, give us 10-to-1. And so you negotiate the terms down, and in the market, these things are being done. But people commenting on the crisis basically were saying that, there are quite some serious consequences to large players getting caught short playing these games. And somebody should be looking out to see what kinds of capital requirements hedge funds should be putting up. And so there was a demand for regulatory capital requirements for at least the larger hedge funds. Now I have quotes in the current version of the paper from the London 2009 G20 meeting where there are explicit statements for putting capital requirements on the larger hedge funds. So I said, okay, that seems like an interesting thing. But how should we do it? And what should be these capital requirements? What are the theoretical foundations for these things? I didn't have much of an idea of how they should be set. So I said, let me answer the question. The funny thing that's happening these days is that there's a lot of interest in doing some kind of regulation, and everyone figures we ought to be doing some, but nobody knows what to do. And so you make it look like you're going to do something, but then you ensure that you don't do anything because you don't know what to do. I mean, so lots of games get played like that. So I just said, let me ask this question and see how we can answer what capital requirements should be set. So the first paper that, this is two papers here. So the first paper that I'll present basically was answering the question of who should set capital requirements, why they should set capital requirements, and how they should set capital requirements. That was the first question, first paper. Then after I wrote that paper, that was published in Quantitative Finance last October, I said, okay, that's a theory piece, answers a bunch of questions, but I like to do things. I like to actually put the numbers up. So I said, let me write a second paper that actually computes what capital requirements I would require of the major U.S. banks as of the end of 2008. And then at the end of writing that paper, I learned that what I valued was something that I could now call a taxpayer put option. And so I said, oh, that's interesting. I didn't even know this was sitting there. And most people were more interested in my taxpayer put than they were in my capital requirements. So I changed the title of the paper and said, it's about taxpayer puts and capital requirements on the side. So that's a secondary thing. I started out with capital requirements being the first thing. But then taxpayer puts were the other thing. And now people are asking other questions that I'll tell you, which just throws the whole thing completely off, and we'll see where the story goes. But the story started with figuring out these questions of capital requirements. Now, in practice, as I mentioned, they are determined in the competitive marketplace with people arguing and having conversations on multiple trading platforms trying to minimize the capital you have to put in and maximize your leverage. And however, I wanted to answer the question as to what we should be trying to do. Now, when you do these things and you try to set capital requirements or things like that, and you come from my background, which is an economic theorist, I've been studying markets and economies for a long time, and a finance professor, we can grow up glorifying the marketplace and understanding the marketplace as the most efficient and best thing in the world. And we tread very hesitantly in prescribing any kind of restrictions on markets. So I say, before we begin, we should understand, and let me start with why we think markets are great, what's our basic foundation there, and has something changed, has something gone wrong, are our assumptions not being met between, what's causing the problems? So I said, let me review for myself and for my audience the fundamental theorems that support the superiority of free market capitalism as we've taught it for years and as we've argued with the Soviet Union and other countries that tried to do it another way, that the best way to go is free market capitalism, and what is the results that deliver what are the assumptions and arguments that deliver this superiority of market capitalism? I said, let me review those to begin with, because we want to be careful in what we're doing here. So I said, we'll see the role played. We'll review the virtues of free market capitalism from a theoretical level, the foundations we now very well understand. And we'll see an important role played by the linear pricing rule in this argument. And then we'll see what's happening today, and it's been happening for a while, but it's happening more and more, is the linear pricing rule plays a very important role in delivering the superiority of free markets. And however, we all set up corporations with limited liability, and that puts a spanner in the works, and you have a non-linearity coming in, and that creates some problems. Now, it didn't create too many problems in the past, but people are very clever, and they develop new and new ways of leveraging the consequences of limited liability. And today, we have a lot of leveraging of such features. In fact, we have companies, inside companies, each one limiting the liability to the parent. Okay, we set these things up, and so much so that we even set up special purpose vehicle structures where basically you have an income stream coming in, you have payments to be made, and you set the structure up and you collect your $1 million fee for setting it up, and you go home and you leave in charge somebody whose job it is to say, if money comes in this box, put it in this box. Well, if they say, put it in this box. And then, if there's no money in this box, there's no money in this box. So the person phones up, he says, I don't speak English. I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, it's gone. And the people have basically collected their commissions up front and gone. And so, you know, we've become very, very good at this business, and nobody's watching. So I said, let me, you know, take a look at this stuff. Now, there is one basic picture that is taught in every graduate class in economics. We spent as an undergraduate a whole semester or a year deriving this result, but in graduate school it was the first half an hour of class where you learned the optimality of free market capitalism. And the story there is the basic separation theorem of two convex sets. And the one convex set is the production possibility set of what the economy can make given two goods. And the other convex set is the better than set. These are your indifference curves. And basically, if you had a central planner, the central planner would say, this is what I want to do. That's maximum utility given my production possibility set. And so the central planner can decide and set up a mathematics laboratory and decide who's going to make what for whom, and the whole economy operates under complete planning. And we said, no, you know, there's a market system that does better, and the purpose of the market system is to come up with a price system, and the job of the price system is to separate the better than set from the production set. And then we can tell Robinson Crusoe, the producer, you know, just go ahead and maximize profits given these prices. And he'll say, okay, that's what I want to produce. And then we tell Robinson Crusoe, take your money home, the profits that you made, and now maximize utility as a consumer. Forget yourself being a producer and decide what you want to buy. And you say, oh, I want to buy what I made. And the job of the economy, of course, is to make sure that the price system is leading people and leading the whole system to basically make the things that people would want to buy when they get their paychecks. And this is a huge simultaneous equation problem. And we have problems in solving simultaneous equations of large size on ordinary computers, and the market tries to solve it through Newton-Raphson gradient iterations of prices. So that's and the linear pricing rule is the basic operator that is doing the separation and plays an important role in this result on the how free markets work and what they do. Now, so I say, okay, let's start from there. Let's start with our idea of a linear pricing rule and profit maximization. Now, of course, in complete markets, when you know the price of everything, namely you have everything trading, you know, if a particular family gets divorced, you can trade the contract that they want to get divorced. You can, you know, you can take positions in everything in complete markets. And you know the price of everything, so there's what we call a unique pricing rule. So the basic black line is unique and knows everything, and we know the prices of all things uniquely. In practice, of course, markets are incomplete, and this measure that actually computes the value of all activities is not known uniquely, and is a huge set of possible measures that one can use to actually define what the profitability of a firm is. And, you know, in incomplete markets, we don't know what the objective function of a firm is. We don't know what the profits are. We don't know what the profit maximization rule is. But let's pretend we pick some measure that's going to be our first candidate for defining profitability and defining what the value of all possible state contingent cash flows are. Now, any such pricing rule is linear functional, and the basic objective is then, from that perspective, to just maximize the expectation of X under the pricing measure. Now, let me bring into the picture our hedge fund. And our hedge fund, these days I say that, you know, thinking about hedge funds is not bad, because in a very real sense, we are all hedge funds. Because any one of us can go into any market and take on the kinds of positions hedge funds take on. And basically, Exxon has a trading floor. Many corporations have trading floors, managing their risks or whatnot, or speculating, whichever they choose to do. You can't stop people from doing what they want to do. And so basically, you know, it's not bad to think of hedge funds, because in some sense, we are all hedge funds. Now, when you want to think of hedge funds, I say think of balance long short. So here you have a portfolio of stocks that you're long and another portfolio of stocks that you're short. And it's $100 million long short. And that's the position you're going to take on. Now, this is the random variable that typical corporation or hedge fund is going to be holding. Now, there's a big difference between this model and the way Bob Merton and people modeled corporations. And there's a huge difference that's coming in from here. The old model of the corporation was, it has random assets and debt and equity as its liabilities. The worst thing that can happen to a corporation as modeled by Merton is that assets go to zero, debt and equity are wiped out, but nothing happens to the rest of us. We are immune. No problem for us. The whole picture changes, and this is what I realized slowly as I kept developing my thoughts and models on this, is here you have unbounded liabilities. If you model your assets like geometric Brownian motion, exponential of a levy, now you short the same bloody thing, then you've got an exponential of a levy on the short side, and you have unbounded liabilities. That changes the picture completely, because with unbounded liabilities, debt and equity can go to zero, but the short position is so far out that there's a $5 billion bill to be paid now. And when anyone sets up a $100 million long short hedge fund, the cash flow that's actually being held by the economy, first of all, you can't hold that and be a pauper. You can't say, I got no money and I want to go $100 million long short. So you're going to have to put up something. Maybe you get leverage 5-1, you put up 20 million. Maybe you get 10-1, you put up 10 million. Maybe you get even better than that, you can put up 5 million. But you got to put up something. You can't just play for no money. Okay, so you put up C, on which you earn the interest rate, and you subtract that from that's what you're going to get, and that's what you put up, that's your profit. That's the profit of what you put onto the economy. However, when you set up a hedge fund or any such corporation, you set it up as limited liability. If I am $100 billion short, what are you going to do? Come and take it from where? I haven't got it, man. Forget it. It's over. So what we do is that. We take positive part of the final outcome. And we put up this C and we take positive part. So the minute you do that, you have a call option here with a strike given by the negative of the cash at stake. And you have basically been given for free the put option, which is the option to put excessive losses back to the economy. Now, I call that the taxpayer put, the option to put losses back to the economy. And you've got that for free. Now, there's nothing wrong in giving people things for free if they're worth a penny, maybe $5. It's all right to give things for free. Now, I'm not saying that limited liability should be paid for, okay? Because that's too damaging. And we've been arguing for years the benefits of limited liability in our classrooms as one of the greatest innovations of finance. Before that, only the landed aristocracy could engage in business and enterprise. And we don't want to go back there. and I don't want to go back to debtors' prisons, and I don't want to charge for it. But somebody should be watching that you're not giving away a too valuable a put option. So the option to put losses back to the economy has a value, and we should try and make sure that it's not too high a value, because it is being given for free. And basically what that value is will be determined by how much you put at stake here. Basically, the higher the cash at stake that you demand, the lower the value of the option to put losses. But you see, when you say, at some point, at one point some years ago, Myron Scholes was arguing all around the country as to how much business, how much capital does it take to run a business. And he kept arguing that, you know, the people that economize on the use of capital are going to be the winners of the world, and all the people that hold excess capital, like Chrysler and other corporations, they're going to be driven out by people that are economizing on capital. And so he economized on capital and returned capital in March and went bankrupt himself in August, okay? But anyway, that was the history. And the point is that how much capital should be held, you see, the society has to hold this, okay? The firm itself is going to do all its damnedest to minimize the capital and maximize leverage. Your incentives are the other way. It's not your job to be deciding the capital. Who should be deciding the capital is outside the firm. Because the outside external economy holds that. They've given you the put option for free. And so they have to watch what the capital should be. So the answer for who is outside. Yeah. No, we do naked shorts now. The people went to Congress and said, listen, we're smart guys. We know what we're doing. We'll buy the stuff if we need it. Why do I have to borrow the stock to short it? I'll just short it and buy it back later. So we have a boatload of naked shorting going on. Back in September 2008, when Morgan Stanley's stock was down at $9, and John Mack went screaming to Hank Paulson and said, save me, save me. So the shorts are murdering us, and they were naked shorts. Not only were they naked shorts, but they were buying the CDS as well. So they collect double. They drive the stock to zero, pick up on the CDS, big money made. Well, that's because of your limited liability.
Right, but
no. But, I mean, in principle, you can lose until the positive part comes in and you say, I can't afford to pay you. I was supposed to buy it back and give it to you, even if you borrowed it. You're supposed to buy it back and you can't do it because you've got no money left.
Right, but the actual loss there was just the $100 that he had in the
bank. Well, no, it's a much more valuable thing. At the time of default. At the time you default, he's lost a lot of money. Because we mark to market all the time. All right? Not the booming high. I mean, it was $100 3 weeks ago. It's about a billion right now. And he sees it. And he's crying. He's saying, where is my bloody thing, man? Give me my baby. It's going to take care of me for the rest of my life. So the firm's objective function is then this thing. Now, well-known consequences. So I have 45 minutes. I've got to watch my time here. But well-known, so I'll move a little bit quickly. Well-known consequences of giving people an option, which is a non-linear operator and not a linear functional anymore. So basically, limited liability puts a spanner in the works of the optimality of free market capitalism, by making the pricing functional that's actually operating nonlinear. And this nonlinearity is well known to introduce adverse risk incentives. You basically want to maximize the value of the option by taking on as much risk as you can, and especially if you tell me that you're going to compensate me as a CEO by the stock price. If you're going to compensate me in proportion to the stock price, I have all the incentive to take on extra risk and maximize the value of this, so much so that I can be like Dick Fuld in some of these movies where they pictured him and showed him yelling and screaming at people at Lehman Brothers for not taking on risk that they didn't want to take on. Okay? But he knew where it led, right into his back pocket. And so there's lots of incentives, adverse risk incentives. Now, my idea was, people have suggested and know this, and they say, okay, how do we solve this problem of risk incentives? And there are people that have written papers on how to solve the adverse risk incentives of limited liability, and one of the suggestions has been, let's hire risk-averse managers. So you go looking for professors, very risk-averse people. These people haven't yet left school. I mean, they're still in school. Go find them. They will run the banks for you. They're good guys, okay? But, you know, once they become managers of big banks and whatnot, they forget that they were professors. And it's not a good solution to find risk-averse managers. So I say that what I'm going to try and do and see is possible is if I can make capital requirements risk sensitive. So I want to get a closed form formula for capital requirements, make it risk sensitive in such a way that the partial derivative of capital with respect to risk is higher than the partial derivative of equity with respect to risk. I know equity has a positive partial with respect to risk. I want to get the capital requirement in such a way that this partial is higher than that partial, so that the adverse risk incentive that this plus sign shoved in here is taken out by my formula. My formula for risk-based capital requirements must remove the adverse risk incentives that limited liability threw into the system. I have to take out. So for that, I need risk-based capital. Now, many people write about risk-based capital, and they write about it in ways of agency problems where I'm a regulator, I control the capital, you're the CEO, you control the risk. I don't like this game, okay? I choose capital, you choose risk after I've chosen the capital. So you knock me out later, okay? You change the risk on me after I pick the capital. So it's not good. I say what we have to do is we have to tell hedge funds, listen, you're smart guys, you're smarter than even me, okay? You know what's going on. You know how to compute risk-based capital. And I'm going to make it a fraud if you are holding risk-based capital not in line with your risk. Okay? And I don't want to know what you're doing. I don't want to know your trading strategies. If ex post I find that you're not holding capital in line with your risk, I make that fraud. That's not normal operation. You go to jail for many, many years. Okay? So, but we need a risk-based formula for capital. So my question was, how do I construct capital required in a risk-based way with closed form so everybody can see what the capital is going to be? So for that, I basically turn to a theory of acceptable risk. So the economy has to decide what the capital is going to be, because they're actually holding the risk, because they're coming back to them in any case. And the first best rule under free market capitalism was make that gap positive. Okay, that's a positive alpha trade. You're earning more than risk compensation. Good, go do it. I say that's too big. That says that you can hold or approve an entire half space of random variables because you're just taking everything that's positive under a single functional. That's just too big. And so, friends of mine years ago developed, 1999 it was, that Philippe Atzner, Freddie Delbayen, Marc Hébert, and David Heath formulated axiomatically what acceptable risks are. And it's very simple. Basically, if you give me money, I will accept it. I will obviously accept the non-negative random variable. Everybody will. The market and the world has no problem with receiving cash. Of course, if you say that I will only accept a non-negative random variable and nothing else, I will not take a single risk, then of course I can't get out of bed, I can't take a flight, I can't catch a bus, nothing I can do. I have to take some exposure to loss. So the simple generalization is to take a cone containing the positive orbit. Just take some cone containing the positive orbit as a minimal generalization of acceptable risk. Now, what's a cone containing the positive orbit? For people here, it's a simple thing. Basically, every convex set is contained in the intersection of the half spaces to which it belongs, and you get your cone by basically looking at positive measures, probability measures, and you take a convex set of probability measures, and you say if you're positive under a convex set of probability measures, you're acceptable. That's the definition of acceptability. That's a perfectly wide, reasonable definition. And I wrote papers on this many times, and many people have written on these measures of acceptability using them and writing results about them. The only thing is that all those papers, and many of those papers, is a lot of abstract results, very good theorems, but no use. They can't actually deliver a single number. They never actually tell you what should be the capital required for anything, what should be the price of anything, what should be anything. Okay? It's just often happens in math. This, if and only if that. This, I don't know. That, I don't know. I just know this, if and only if that. That's all I know. And so, you know, we want some numbers and we want to make this thing operational. And so I chased this idea to try to get it operational. And the way we did that was with work with Alexander Cherny, who came from Moscow to work with me at Maryland for a while and said, you know, I want to work on this topic. And I said, the only thing to work on here is to make it operational. And it's not a good idea to say that whether something is going to be acceptable or not depends only on its probability law. It's not a good idea. A simple example. Let's say you offer me $1 million next week if I end up homeless. Or you offer me $1 million next week if I end up a billionaire. Maybe the probability law of those two is the same. I'm equally likely to be homeless next week as a billionaire next week. Probability law is the same. Obviously, I prefer $1 million if I'm homeless to $1 million if I'm a billionaire. If I'm a billionaire, you take $1 million, I don't care. Okay? So things don't depend on probability laws. It's not a good idea. But as a first cut, maybe, in fact, everything we do is like that. A lot of decision criteria used in decision sciences are all based on probability laws. Expected utility is based on the probability law. Sharpe ratios are probability law. Gain-loss ratios are probability law. Everything we do is lousy. A lot of what we're doing is lousy. So I say, let's stick with the lousy. It's all right. Okay? I just work with the probability law. Now, if I work with the probability law, and I want to define acceptability using probability law, then there's a very nice construction that came up from work of Kusioka in 2001, which basically said that something is acceptable if and only if it has positive expectation under concave distortion. And so you have to pick a function that you use for it. So the distribution function is f, psi is a concave distortion, and if it's positive under concave distortion, you say it's acceptable. And you can describe very nicely the collection of test measures, the set M that is one is using, in order for this to be acceptable. But for our purposes here, and for my applications, basically my issue was to pick the distortion. And so I chose many distortions I started with. First, I started with this one, without the 1 plus gamma there. And that distortion, one could explain to a trader very simply. It just says, draw from the distribution gamma times. And if the expectation of a minimum of gamma draws is positive, do it. Okay, so if I draw 100 times or 1,000 times and the expectation of the minimum of 1,000 independent draws is still positive and you don't want to do it, go home. What are you doing on Wall Street? You can't take that risk? Forget it. So that was good. So then I didn't like it because basically expectation under concave distortion is also expectation and the change of measure. And this is the original measure. That's the change of measure. This is the expectation. And when F goes to zero, you're losing trillions of dollars. And I want the reweighting to go to infinity. And the distortion I told you about doesn't have that property. The maximum reweighting is 1 plus gamma at zero. Now, I want both risk aversion and absence of gain enticement. If you come and tell me, hey man, I can make a couple of billion dollars, I say, yeah, keep it to you. Keep the story to yourself. So I want to shave the gains, and I want to inflate the losses. So I want the derivative of, I want this derivative to go to zero at one and go to infinity at zero. And the distortion that I have been using, min max var, does that. So that was the, this distortion does that. So I've been working with this one. Now it's very simple. I say that's the cash flow that the economy has to hold. I want to make it acceptable. So I want this property. You play around with change of variables and you get this result. This is a closed form, risk-based formula for required capital. Give me the distribution function. I do the distortion. I compute the expectation. I compute capital required. And now I can even compute the derivative of capital required with respect to volatility and see if it is high enough to compensate the adverse derivative of equity value. So this is where I went with this. And I basically can show you, these are I started with the model that Tom Hurd wrote on pricing spread options, because over here our long-short hedge fund is a spread option, because we have basically exponential levy long, exponential levy short, and then we're computing the equity value is an option on assets minus liabilities, and so it's a spread option. And I really enjoyed and loved Tom's paper, which I implemented last July, use Fourier methods and double two-dimensional Fourier methods to integrate out both these risks and compute the value of a spread option. And that's what I've been using for all my equity value calculations, because I need to know what's the derivative of equity with respect to risk, and then have I unwound that with my capital requirement. And so a simple calculation here, you see the equity partials, and you can see this beta is like the correlation between assets and liabilities. And the risk incentives, if you want to maximize stock market value and equity value, is you don't want assets and liabilities. You don't want to do hedging, man. The last thing you want to do is hedge. You want your liabilities to be uncorrelated with your assets to boost up the vol and raise the stock price. And so the incentive from the point of view of stock price is to anti-hedge, okay, and to have a negative beta. So you can see that all the partials with respect to volatility and risk are all wrong, all the wrong way. I mean, everything you want to do is to just keep taking on risk, keep taking on skew, take on kurtosis, decorrelate assets and liabilities. You know, you just want to go crazy on the risk dimension. And so now I put in my capital requirements, and I look at capital adjusted partials, and I say over here, if you pick the stress level gamma, which is the degree of concavity of the distortion, and basically the more the concavity of the distortion, the more the test measures that have to sign off on the deal, the bigger the set M of test measures. And so if you pick it not too high, you still have incentives to decorrelate. If you pick it high enough at 0.75, you don't want to decorrelate anymore, and you correct all the risk incentives. So I settled on 0.75 to be the number, and or at least for the moment the number, and I showed that, okay, capital requirements, conservatively enough set, could possibly be a way to mitigate the adverse risk incentives that limited liability has thrown into the system, and we have gotten so clever at leveraging that limited liability that we're going gung-ho on it, okay? We're setting up organizations that basically leverage that to the hilt. And it's very nice if we can keep doing that and nobody's watching. Because it'd be nice. It's a sweet deal to pick up $1 million every other day. And go home with it. So then I said I wanted to compute these capital requirements for the banks. So here's what I do. I can explain this picture. I don't have to go through in... Well, there's a couple of things. Maybe if I just say the things, I can stay in time. One of the editors asked me, he said, Dilip, okay, there is incentive for CEOs and stockholders to go crazy on risk. But won't debt holders control that risk, as they traditionally do? Because debt holders tend to lose if too much risk is taken, and they have covenants and whatnot to control risk. So I looked at that question, and to my surprise, it was very nice to see that now the debt holders and equity holders together own the option to put losses to the taxpayer. As a firm, they own that. Yes, they have sold an option to equity holders to put losses back to them at a higher strike. So they actually hold a put spread, okay? And now it's no longer clear that they want to control risk. And I give simple examples and show that in many situations, debt holders' incentives to control risk have disappeared. They don't want to do it anymore, okay? Once they have a valuable taxpayer put. And so that is a difference. Another difference is what the value of... you know, if I just go to the value of equity. So the value of equity is up there. It's assets minus liabilities, F and cash on hand. Now, M is the cash on hand, and that's the value of equity. Now, you can see that equity, the more cash on hand you have, the lower is the strike of the equity, and the higher is the equity value. And so when Hank Paulson, I was reading Hank Paulson's book on the plane on the brink, and Hank Paulson is telling Dick Ford, he says, Dick, I mean, you got to get some cash, man. You don't have enough cash in blooming Lehman. He says, you know, when I was CEO of Goldman, we had a safe with $60 billion in it. We were holding a lot of cash. You need some cash. So he says, no. I got enough cash. We're okay. Okay, in the classical model, cash doesn't matter. Okay, in the classical model, just assets and liabilities, no cash. But now cash is important. And so important that Hank Paulson called all the CEOs in and said, you know what? You're getting $25 billion cash. You're getting 10. You're getting 15. You're getting 5. And by tomorrow morning, you have it. I'm giving it to you. You can't say no. And he forced the cash on them because that's the only way he could support the stock price. It was, you had to punch the cash in. And then Congress comes in and just tells, you know, these guys got cash and they're not lending. They can't lend. That cash has to be held as reserve. You can't use it to grow the balance sheet. It's a different world. If the market says you haven't got enough cash to cover your unlimited liabilities and you're boosting your stock price with the cash, you better hold that cash. You can't lend it. And so those are two new pictures that come out, which I wasn't aware of when I wrote the paper. And now I say, okay, I want to work out the capital required for these banks, and I want to work out the value of the taxpayer put, the value of putting losses back to the economy, which is basically this put option here. Basically, it's a option on A minus L with a strike given by the negative cash. I want to work out the value of this put. Now, to do this, I need the probability law of A and L. And where am I going to get that? So I say, okay, I've been calibrating equity option surfaces for 20 years. I have all the data on equity options. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to take assets and liabilities, and I'm going to write down a joint law for their evolution. And I write down a reasonably complex joint law. They are basically linear mixtures of correlated Levy processes. And it's a rich law because in my correlated Levy processes, I have shocks that hit both sides of the balance sheet adversely. They take assets down and liabilities up, and have other shocks that hit assets and liabilities in a compensating way. If you just did your bun in motion, you can't do that. You can't have two kinds of shocks. So I do that. I take a reasonably complex model. And then I say, I'm going to simulate this model. And when I simulate this model, I'm going to get a time path of assets and liabilities for a year or two. Now, given the time path of assets and liabilities, I take Tom Hurd's paper, and I hit it. Say, give me the time path of stock prices. Because, I mean, you know that equity value is a spread option. Here are my A&L. Transform a path of A&L to a path of equity prices. Now, once I have a path of equity prices, I can compute equity options. I've got the strike, I compute maturity, I get equity option price. I got a simulation, I get equity options. From the equity options, I can look at the market prices of equity options and match the two. And so I can find the probability law for the joint evolution of A&L that best fits the equity options surface. And then I have the law, so I can compute capital required, I can compute value of taxpayer put. Okay? Now, in doing this, I start with the balance sheet data, and they tell me what A&L they have, the banks. I mean, these are just probability laws. I get the balance sheet data. J.P. Morgan had this much assets, this much. When I say assets, I say net of cash. Cash is separate. I take the cash out because cash is my strike. So for me, cash and things are different. And then when you start your simulation and you apply Tom's spread option calculator with this A and this L, you don't get the stock price on your parameter values. Obviously, I can't price an option on stock if on day one I don't price the stock. Okay? I got no hope of pricing options on stock if I'm missing on day one. Okay, so I say, you know what? I'm not getting this price from this A&L. So I'm going to say, you know, you guys are lying. You said your A was this, probably less. You said your L was that, probably more. So I put a fudge factor in. I say, what's the percentage by which you guys are lying? So I shave the assets, I raise the liabilities, till I hit that stock price. That's my adjustment factor, and then I do my simulation, and then I let the whole thing run. And so then I get the joint law of everything, and I basically estimate this is my, you know, linear mixture of four variance gammas that does the calibration, and I basically compute this kind of table where the reserves that they were holding was that much in billions. That's the capital required that I was saying that these banks should be holding as of the end of 2008. That's the value of the limited liability put. It's very low for Goldman Sachs. Market has a very good view of Goldman Sachs. And that was my adjustment factor, which was also lowest for Goldman Sachs. So that's basically this exercise theoretically what I mean by what capital required should be and what the value of the taxpayer put is. Now I realize also debtors have lost their incentives to monitor risk and cash is important for equity. And this is one example of how one does a calibration like this using the option surface. So I think I'm 5 minutes over, but that's not too bad. Well, so I write down a joint law for A&L as exponentials of Levy processes that are linear mixtures of four independent Levy processes. Now, the mixing matrix I have to find. Okay? So I take that mixing, I design it. Because I say that I have four variance gammas running, and every time a variance gamma moves, it's going to hit on some ray given by the linear mixture. Okay, so I've got rays, I've got a two-sided process, so I don't have to traverse 360 degrees for my assets and liabilities. I only have to go 180 degrees. So I say, okay, I'll take two positive angles, two negative angles. So I took an angle at 30 degrees, 60 degrees, 120, and 150. and I have covariance gammas running there, and then my linear coefficients are given like that. So I basically set up this, I think you can see it here, is my x and y. X and y are the log of assets and log of liabilities, and they're given by that linear mixture of four independent variance gamma processes. And so I simulate this thing, which gives me time paths of A and L, and then I use Tom's spread option calculator to convert that to equity prices, and then I have a patch space of equity prices from which I can compute equity option prices, and then I have market equity option prices, and I say, okay, guys, find me the numbers that match the surface. And for example, this is a particular calibrate. The whole thing takes a couple of hours, but who cares? I mean, that's fine. And this is the blue circles are the market data on equity options and JP Morgan on December 31, 2008. And the red dots are the market prices, the model prices. And it's not perfect. It's not good because I know that if I use a Sato process, I'll do a better job. I know Sato processes fit the surface. I've already written papers showing Levy processes won't fit the surface. But I wanted to keep things simple because Levy processes, maybe the world knows, because they're 20, 30 years old. Sato processes are only 3 years old. So I wanted to build up my audience, and so I used Levy instead of Sato. I knew I was paying in terms of fit. But that's okay. Hear this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so for example, Mr. Wells Fargo is also pretty high up there, and they've just swallowed. JP had just swallowed Bear Stearns. Wells Fargo had just swallowed Wachovia. And this is still early days. They haven't adjusted their stuff yet. So maybe it's the market's reflecting that. Morgan and Goldman had swallowed nothing. And I was happy that Morgan came out not too bad there because I worked for them. and of course, yeah, Goldman is a special place.